The final chapter of the unit has to do with membrane structure and function. We've already talked about a little bit of this, including what's really shown in slide one. What is this thing in the blue background picture? It is what? A phospholipid bilayer, exactly. And the phospholipid bilayer is not a complete plasma membrane, but every plasma membrane of every cell that's ever existed is made of mostly phospholipid bilayer. There's other things in there as well in a living cell. But you don't have to have anything alive, remember, to create a phospholipid bilayer. All you have to have are phospholipids and water. And this is how the first cell-like structures came into existence, which eventually became the first cells that are ancestors to all of us. Remember, we talked about the fact that the lightning and the inorganic materials were reacting because of the lightning to create organic materials, including phospholipids. So these things are just accumulating over 800 million years. That's a long time. So a lot of accumulation in the oceans where life started. Until eventually, when there's so many of them, they're so close to each other, so there's such a high concentration of them, they just interact with each other to automatically form a phospholipid bilayer. And why do they do that? What is it about a phospholipid that causes a group of them to form a phospholipid bilayer? Exactly. A phospholipid is an amphipathic molecule. But what does that mean? Right, it means that it has a polar part on one part of this molecule and a nonpolar part on that same molecule. Well, the words hydrophilic and hydrophobic are used here. Hydrophilic linguistically means water-loving because polar things are hydrophilic. They don't mind being around water, which is polar. So they love water, is what the word means. Hydrophobic, water-fearing, means or refers to something that is nonpolar, because nonpolar things do not want to be around polar things, including water. And the tails of a phospholipid are nonpolar and therefore hydrophobic. What is it about the tails that makes them hydrophobic or nonpolar? Structurally speaking, what can you tell me about the tails of a phospholipid? They are hydrocarbons, exactly. Or they're not. The only thing that keeps them from being a hydrocarbon is there's an oxygen at the one end where they connect to the glycerol that's in the head here. But the whole rest of the tail is hydrocarbon. And hydrocarbons in general are nonpolar because they're made up of carbon-carbon bonds, which obviously are nonpolar, right? Why is it obvious that a carbon-carbon bond is nonpolar? Because they're the same atoms, so they have identical electronegativities, right? But the only other kind of bond in a hydrocarbon is a carbon-hydrogen bond, and carbon and hydrogen have close enough to identical electronegativities that that's also nonpolar. So the tails are trying to avoid water. To do that, you form two monolayers, with each monolayer's tails facing the tails of the other monolayer. Okay, that's how life got started. Slide two shows you that a living cell's plasma membrane is more than just phospholipids. To live, a cell can't have a plasma membrane made purely out of phospholipids. And that's because a phospholipid bilayer is a boundary through which certain things can pass, but not all things. I talked about selective permeability in the lab last time, right? A pure phospholipid bilayer can let certain things through, but not other things. Well, some of the things that can't easily get through a phospholipid bilayer happen to be things that cells have to get into or out of them to remain alive. That's why a living cell, in addition to having its phospholipid bilayer substructure, has to have other things in there as well to make up the plasma membrane. And chief among those other things, besides the phospholipids, are these purple, in the cartoon form, proteins. There are all kinds of proteins that are part of the membrane because they are tied or bound to the membrane, which is why these proteins are called membrane-bound proteins. Remember, I've already discussed the difference between the phrases membrane-bound and membrane-bounded. These are membrane-bound proteins, not membrane-bounded. They're not surrounded by their own membranes like a mitochondrion is. A mitochondrion is membrane-bounded. These are membrane-bound proteins. And they do all kinds of different things that we'll take a look at in a minute. But importantly, what's shown here is that these proteins that are part of a membrane are not chemically bound to the phospholipids. And they therefore aren't held in place by rigidly. What is it that keeps this protein in the membrane thickness? Why doesn't it just leave outside or go fully inside the cell? Well, remember what you already have learned about a polypeptide, a protein. A single polypeptide, like the ribbon model shows, is a continuous strand of amino acids, one after another, forming peptide bonds between them. But it doesn't remain as a stretched out string of beads. Instead, it forms some sort of three-dimensional structure because it folds on itself various ways. And remember that there are 20 biological amino acids that are used by organisms, but we group those into polar, nonpolar, and charged groups, right? Well, this, even though it's no ribbon is shown here, this is a ribbon. And so it's a bunch of amino acids. Each amino acid has an R group, but each R group, the R groups that are in this region of the protein happen to be from the nonpolar group of amino acids. And so they don't have any problem being around the equally nonpolar tails. The nonpolar R groups that are in this part of the protein are, in other words, hydrophobic, just like the tails are. But the amino acids that are on the upper end and the bottom end of this same protein are polar R groups. And those polar groups don't want to be around these tails. They want to be around the polar heads. And that is what keeps this protein where it is. If you imagine trying to push this protein downward in the picture, which would be to push it out of the membrane into the interior of the cell, doing that means that you would have to force this polar part, which is at the top of the protein, to be exposed to these nonpolar tails. Kind of like trying to push a North Pole magnet to another North Pole magnet. They repel each other, right? So it's going to resist doing that. And if you just take your finger off of it after you've pushed it partially into the thickness, it's just going to pop right back in place so that the nonpolar R groups match up to the tails and the polar R groups match up to the heads. Okay, so they're just buoyed in place because of hydrophobic or hydrophilic regions. Slide 3 is a cartoon rendering of a special technique called freeze fracturing that allows a plasma membrane to be split into its two monolayers. If you make it cold enough, you can split the two. And the reason they're doing this in this figure is to indicate that although there's all kinds of different membrane-bound proteins in a plasma membrane, most of those membrane-bound proteins are more associated with the inner monolayer, the part that's next to the interior of the cell, rather than the outer layer, There are some ones that are associated with the extracellular layer, but that's why on the photomicrograph, this doesn't look nearly as rough, because the roughness is the proteins. There's a lot more proteins associated with the interior. And that makes sense, of course, because there's a lot more chemistry happening inside the cell, right? That's where metabolism is occurring, and therefore those proteins are more likely to interact with things inside the cell. Now to four. We need to now talk about the fluid mosaic model of membrane structure. And let's just talk about what a mosaic is in everyday language, not in biology. What is a mosaic? Anyone know the word? Specifically to make an artwork. So instead of a painting, for instance, which is just paint on a surface, a mosaic forms the image by gluing little tiles or pieces of glass or any little thing, each of which is kind of like a pixel of a video photograph, put onto a wall or some surface, and that forms the image. That's a mosaic. Fluid is just an adjective meaning able to flow, in other words, change shape. So an artwork mosaic doesn't do this, because the pieces, whatever they are, glued into place. Well, the reason that the plasma membrane is like a mosaic is because each individual phospholipid is kind of like one of the tiles in an artwork mosaic. Here you have a phospholipid bilayer that we're looking at on its edge, but you can imagine looking at this from top. If you look at from the top, you would see all these heads, right? Each head is like one of the tiles in a mosaic. But unlike an artwork mosaic that's not fluid, the reason we call this a fluid mosaic is that those individual phospholipids can move around with respect to each other. They're not held, just like the proteins that I talked about earlier are not chemically bonded to the phospholipids. Well, the phospholipids are not chemically bonded to each other either. So these things are free to move around just like a crowd of people is made up of a bunch of people, each of which is able to move around. Like if on New Year's Eve at Times Square, if you on a skyscraper in New York City, you look down, you see a mass of drunk people, right? You see all their heads, just like the heads of these phospholipids. And if you take a picture at one time and then an hour later, they're not going to be in exactly the same position anymore, because they're all moving with respect to each other like a crowd does. That's what happens with these phospholipids. There is so-called lateral movement, meaning to the side. This is lateral movement refers to phospholipids that are in the same monolayer switching places with each other. And that happens, maybe it's surprising how often that happens, surprising to you, about 10 million times per second these phospholipids are moving around. So this is just part, just one of many reasons why you should never think of a cell as being a static or unchanging bag. It is highly organized, but also highly dynamic. From second to second, it is never the same. It's always changing. One of the reasons, though, is because of this lateral movement. Now, there's also possible the so-called flip-flop, but notice how infrequent that is, only about once per month. Flip-flop refers to exchange of one phospholipid in one monolayer with a phospholipid in the other monolayer. Why is that much more rare? Well, if you imagine forcing that to happen, you would have to temporarily expose the head of this top monolayer to the tail region where it doesn't want to be, right? Once you got it more than halfway, though, then it would snap into place into the bottom monolayer. So it doesn't happen very often, but it is possible. That's the fluid mosaic model, and how fluid a plasma membrane is important. It's possible for a membrane to be too fluid, too loose, or too tight in order to do its job of forming a boundary and allowing only certain things through it. Phospholipids are what are making this bilayer, but remember, just like there are different fats, there are also different kinds of phospholipids. They're similar to fats, remember, except that a fat is not amphipathic, and that's because all three of that glycerol's connection points are used to connect fatty acids, which are nonpolar. That's a triglyceride or a fat. A phospholipid uses just two phospholipids connected to the glycerol, and that third spot on the glycerol is connected to a phosphate, which is ionized. That's what makes it the polar head. Okay, but anyway, just like in fats, which involve fatty acids, phospholipids involve fatty acids. And what are the two major categories of fatty acids that I talked about? Saturated and unsaturated. A saturated fatty acid is one that has only single bonds between its carbons and therefore is not bent, like the unbent wires I was talking about throwing into a box. They stack together neatly and tightly. So if you make your membrane out of phospholipids that have only saturated fatty acids, it's going to be less fluid, more solid. Well, that might be appropriate if the temperature is high, for instance, because as the temperature increases, it's going to make everything looser, just like a butter is going to start to melt, right, at a higher temperature. The plasma membrane will get too loose if it's hot. And therefore, the cell can respond by changing the phospholipids that make up its plasma membrane using phospholipids that feature more saturated fatty acids and therefore pack together. That'll tighten it up. Just the opposite is true if it gets too cold. If it's too cold, it's not going to be loose enough. The cold is going to tighten up the plasma membrane, and the cell can respond by loosening it up by making its plasma membrane out of phospholipids that have more unsaturated fatty acids that are bent and therefore don't pack together as tightly. The bottom shows you that in addition to phospholipids and proteins, not shown here, but that are important, animals also have an important component in their plasma membrane, which is cholesterol. Cholesterol is an animal product. Plants make similar things that are called phytosterols, but they don't make cholesterol. And other groups, like fungi, make ergosterols. So there's different sterols that are part of membranes in the various eukaryotic groups. But in animals, cholesterol, I've already told you how important it is because it's the precursor molecule to all the steroid hormones in animals. But it's also an important component in animal plasma membranes. It can fill up little gaps, as you see here. So it's another way of adjusting the fluidity, how much cholesterol is there. And it's not only does it affect the fluidity, it also affects how easily ions are able to get through the membrane. Slide 5. I told you what the fluid mosaic model is, but when this was proposed as a hypothesis, of course, it's important in science to demonstrate whether that the predictions for a hypothesis come true or not, in other words, to test it. And that's what this cartoon is, the results of an experiment to test whether the fluid mosaic model is true. So they used two different cells, a mouse cell, as you see, and a human cell, each of which has various membrane-bound proteins. The colored dots are proteins that are embedded in the membrane. And as you probably already know, a mouse cell has some proteins that are not found in humans and vice versa. There are human proteins, mouse proteins. Each cell is going to have its own. Now, they are magenta and purple or lilac, whatever color this is in this cartoon, but they aren't really colored in real life. They have to be, in a sense, colored, though, or marked so that the researchers know where they are. They need to be able to follow where they are. So they used a labeling technique that's not really important how they did it. That's what the color represents, a way to detect where each kind of protein is. Because they then took the two cells and fused them into one hybrid cell, which is pretty easy to do because membrane material is membrane material, even for mouse and human. It's made up of phospholipids, and it's like getting two fat droplets, two oil droplets on the surface of water together, right? They'll coalesce into one. Similarly, these, just like vesicles merge within a cell, two cells can merge. And at the very moment this first happens, this fusion of the two cells, obviously one end of the cell is going to have all the mouse proteins and the other end is going to have all the human proteins. Well, if the fluid mosaic model were not true, then you would expect that to stay the case. In other words, come back later and you would still have mouse proteins only on one end of the hybrid and human proteins only on the other end of the hybrid. But that's not what they saw. They saw what you would expect if the fluid mosaic model is true, meaning after a while, and only took about an hour, these proteins, because they're free to move around in the membrane, just like the phospholipids are going to migrate. They're going to diffuse from where there's a high concentration to a low concentration. There's two gradients here, one for mouse proteins and one for human proteins, and they saw an equal mixing of the two. So that's a pretty good indication that the fluid mosaic model is actually true. Now to slide 6. Here we have a piece of membrane and various purple colored membrane-bound proteins. We still haven't looked at the major jobs that these membrane-bound proteins do, but we will in a minute. Here I want to talk about the fact that there are two major categories of membrane-bound proteins, not based on what they do at all, just based on how they are situated in the membrane. One category, represented by these two that are labeled here on the inner surface, is peripheral proteins. Peripheral is the adjective of periphery, which just means the edge. A peripheral protein is a membrane-bound protein, but a peripheral protein does not extend into the thickness of the phospholipid bilayer. It is on one edge or the other, either intracellular heads it's associated with or extracellular phospholipid heads. It doesn't go into the thickness where the tails are. It's still free to move around, but it's just going to skate along these heads, basically. That's a peripheral protein. The other major category is integral proteins, which are also labeled here. They're called integral proteins because they are more a part of the integrity, or what holds the whole membrane together, compared to the peripheral proteins. And that's because for a membrane-bound protein to be an integral protein, it has to actually protrude at least partly through the thickness. It's associated not just with heads of the phospholipids, but with tails as well. But unfortunately, this book chose to draw every one of its integral proteins as not only associated with tails to some degree, but actually sticking all the way through the thickness of the membrane. That they are definitely integral proteins, but not all integral proteins stick all the way through the thickness. So you just have to imagine, since they didn't draw one for you, a protein sticking, let's say, roughly halfway through the thickness. That would still be an integral protein. The ones that they have labeled here as integral proteins are not only integral proteins, they are a special subset of integral proteins, since they stick all the way through the thickness, and those are called transmembrane proteins. So all transmembrane proteins are integral proteins, but not all integral proteins are transmembrane proteins. Transmembrane just means through the membrane or across the membrane. across the thickness, in other words. Well, they can be. You don't have any idea just by looking at them what's going on this part that's not associated with the membrane. But this end would be certainly amino acids that are polar. That's what makes them want to be around these heads. The transmembrane or any integral protein have to be partly, have some that are polar and some that are nonpolar, which is what keeps them there. Oh, before I leave this figure, let me just show you that when you look at this outer surface, you'll notice that there's a bunch of these green hexagons, each of which is a monosaccharide, but they're hooked together. So these are polysaccharides, or at least oligosaccharides. They're not single sugars. They're complex sugars. But notice that some of them are connected to phospholipids, like this one. And this makes up a complex molecule called a glycolipid. Glyco, just like in glycosidic, means sugar. So it's a glycolipid if the sugar part is connected to a lipid, which a phospholipid is. But some of these sugars are connected to proteins, and so there are also glycoproteins. And one thing that we'll see in a different slide, that these carbohydrates, these sugars hanging off of these membrane molecules do, is to serve as little ID badges, more or less, to show in a multicellular organism that I am one of you. I'm not an invading organism. All right, 7. Here we see a ribbon model now, so you can see that this is all one polypeptide. That this is a transmembrane protein, right? It goes all the way through the thickness. But notice its secondary structure. The secondary structure is whether or not it has helices and beta-pleated sheets. Well, this one happens to have a lot of alpha helices. And each helix is acting like one stave of a barrel. You have many pieces of a barrel that form a hollow structure. Well, this is forming a hollow tunnel through the membrane. And so that's just one of several important functions of membrane-bound proteins. Some of them act as little tunnels which allow for transport of things into or out of the cell without actually going directly through the phospholipid bilayer. Like I said earlier, some things don't easily get through the phospholipid bilayer. And those things that need to get into or out of the cell but can't go directly through the phospholipid bilayer need the help of transport proteins. Okay, now in 8, we can see 6 major different categories of functions that membrane-bound proteins perform. Now, any individual membrane-bound protein has just one of these functions. It's not that a protein can do any of these. It's just that there are 6 major categories that membrane-bound proteins in general, category of proteins, perform. So first we have transport, and I've already talked about this a little in the previous slide. Now some sorts of particles don't need the help of a transport protein, because some things can easily go right through the thickness of the phospholipid bilayer directly. For a particle to do that, to go through the phospholipid bilayer directly, 2 things have to be true of that particle. One is that it has to be small enough. If it's too big, it's just not going to go through. But smallness, even though that is a requirement, is not enough. That's necessary but not sufficient. For instance, a proton, which also goes by what name? Well, specifically, what kind of ion? It's a hydrogen ion. Right. A proton is just a hydrogen ion, an H+. It is plenty small, right? It's not even as big as an atom. It's just a proton. But as tiny as they are, they still don't easily go directly through the phospholipid bilayer, because being an ion, a proton is charged, which means it's beyond polar, right? Polar things don't like to be around these nonpolar tails. So ions, in general, don't easily get through the phospholipid bilayer because they're charged. So the other requirement for a particle, besides being small, to get through the membrane, I mean the bilayer directly, is to be nonpolar. You have to be small enough and nonpolar enough. If you are big and nonpolar, you're excluded from going directly through. If you're small and nonpolar, I mean and polar, then you're also excluded. Okay, so if a particle is small and polar or charged, or big and nonpolar, or big and polar, then it's going to need the help of a protein embedded in the membrane to get through the membrane. It doesn't go directly through the phospholipid bilayer. And that's what those proteins that do that help collectively are called transport proteins. Transport here specifically refers to what is better called transmembrane transport. Motor proteins that we talked about before are transport proteins, but those are about moving things from one place inside the cell to another place inside the cell. Here we're talking about transmembrane transport, which means moving things either out of the cell or into the cell through the membrane. Okay, now there are different categories here corresponding to passive and active, which we've already discussed in the lab, right? Passive transport proteins don't require any external energy. What's the energy source for them to work? The gradient. Passive transport operates on a gradient. But if you want to force something to move in the direction opposite what it wants to move in according to its gradient, in other words, if you want to move it up its gradient rather than down, you're going to have to force that to happen by supplying outside energy, often but not always in the form of ATP. Okay, so transport, that's one of the six major categories. Enzymatic activity just refers to these membrane-bound proteins acting as enzymes. Remember, I told you that a huge fraction of your total number of proteins are acting as enzymes in general, but most of those are occurring inside the cell. Well, it's the same job here. It's acting as a catalyst, so a substrate is binding and getting turned into a product. They just happen to be, these enzymes happen to be part of the membrane. That's where they're doing their job. And then signal transduction, I probably shouldn't start, no, because I don't want to tell you partially about that. So just remind me that I'm on C.